The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Would you mind starting from the top?
Okay, I made a film with Dean, my boyfriend, and the idea was that we were gonna, you know, make this experimental film, an artistic film.
Porno film?
That's just the commercial element, okay? Okay? Sid said we had to have that. And the reality was, we were getting our message out there, and it was all in the film. Names and dates and everything that my mom was doing. And once it was out there, once it was in theaters, there's no way that they could suppress it. There's no way that they could cover it up.
So let me get this straight. You made a porno film where the point was the plot.
What's your hang-up, man?
Hey, everyone. It's another Loose Cannons podcast coming at you. Today, we're going to be discussing 2016's The Nice Guys, directed by Shane Black. But before we do that, let's do this little segment we like to call Heralds and Denouncements. Patrick?
I have a few things that I could herald, but I think that most of them are probably going to end up on my end of the year list at this point. So I would rather go ahead and herald the television show because I've been watching a lot of TV lately. I want to herald the show Brooklyn Nine-Nine. If I had to describe it, I'd say it's sort of a spiritual successor to Parks and Recreation. It's shot similarly, although they sort of eschew the faux documentary style, but it still has that same kind of like camera work to it. I guess the fly on the wall camera work, if you had to describe it. But sure. I also want to herald Chelsea Peretti. She was sort of my like biggest discovery from that show. I didn't realize like how hilarious she is, despite how much Pete Holmes talks about her. But yeah, she's really funny. And her stand-up that's on Netflix, One of the Greats, is really funny too. So check that out.
That's one of my favorite specials from last year, for sure. It's really good.
Basil?
I'm going to herald Dread.
Woo!
I rewatched it for the first time in its entirety since I saw it in the theater. It's still pretty awesome. I didn't like it quite as much as I did in the theater, maybe because I didn't have the weirdo 3D to go along with it. But I didn't like the action sequences quite as much as I did the first time. But the whole vibe of the movie is pretty sweet. I liked it. Carl Urban was willing to not show his face the entire movie. He's like a somewhat big movie star, and he's like, sure, you can just show my chin for 95 minutes and nothing else. Just the whole sort of dystopic setup is pretty sweet. The kind of like ins and outs, the way it sort of makes it pretty apparent that the judges are sort of this like creepy fascist thing, but that also seems like a logical extension of where policing and everything is going from where it is now, sadly.
True that. Another good Alex Garland screenplay too.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm frantically trying to remember some stuff that I watched last week that I really liked. And since I'm not logging any movies for some dumb reason, I only remember right now while having watched Sense and Sensibility and it being pretty fun, but also really weirdly cast. Like, I feel like Hugh Grant is just completely lost in that movie. And I feel like casting Alan, like Alan Rickman, like for all of my love of Alan Rickman and him recently having passed away, not wanting to say anything bad about him, he's just also kind of a weird casting decision in this movie, because like his whole love affair with Kate Winslet, who was like 18 or whatever she's supposed to be in this movie, and he's like over 50, and somehow theirs is the love that is the most pure in this whole movie. Pretty weird, but yeah, I pretty much enjoyed all the like weird and purposely awkward bits of dialogue. I think Emma Thompson is a pretty good writer, and she seems like a pretty cool person in general. So yeah, I like a tentative thumbs up for that one.
Nice.
Instead of a Herald, I guess.
I am going to herald something that will probably end up on my best of the year list.
Nice.
And it's a little movie called Now You See Me Too. Little independent film, you might not have heard of it.
Woohoo!
Even though the action's not quite as good as the first one, because John M. Chu is not as good an action director as Louis Leterrier.
Yeah,
I didn't say his name.
It's pretty close.
It's just as dumb as the first one, which is exactly what I was looking for.
It's great.
And it's way funnier because they've replaced Isla Fisher, who is not a particularly good actress, with Lizzie Caplan in the core four, and they just let Lizzie Caplan go wild, which is really nice, because I believe the last movie that I saw her in was The Interview, where she sort of has to play like the straight man.
Yeah.
To James Franco and Seth Rogen, and so she doesn't really get to do anything, whereas in this movie it's kind of like all four men are the straight men, and Lizzie Caplan is like the wacky character who does like whatever she wants in like every scene, and I laughed at her in pretty much every single scene that she's in. So
I'm also excited about that one because I like the first one a lot too.
Yeah, me too.
Nice.
It's very strange. Most people are just like, those movies are so dumb, I hate them. But like, I'm like, that's exactly what I want from them.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh man, I wonder if this is gonna be another Magic Mike 2 situation. It's on everyone's list but mine.
Yep. Might be.
I don't like this nearly as much as I liked Magic Mike XXL.
Yeah.
I definitely think Magic Mike XXL was like pretty good movie. This is just like super dumb and super fun.
Nice.
All right.
Speaking of super dumb,
let's move into the main portion of this podcast, where bringing you another fairly recent release. Very recent if you're in Germany, Australia,
yeah.
But not quite as recent if you're in the U.S. like us. We're going to be discussing The Nice Guys, as I already mentioned, and not to give away too much of a spoiler, but you know, maybe if we all liked it, the end sort of hints that maybe there's going to be sequels. So who knows? This could be the new Fast and Furious franchise. Fast and Furious is still going. So new Hunger Games that we do all the movies for.
Guess we'll have to find out.
It's true.
Who knows? Yeah. Every year we'll come back with a new installment of The Nice Guys.
The 21st century Lethal Weapon.
hopefully better than where that series ended up.
Magic.
Yeah, so I will do the plot since I was the kind of champion on this one. Yeah, so the movie takes place in Los Angeles during the 1970s. It starts with Ryan Gosling, who is a private detective, we start out with a woman who is a porn actress crashing her car and dying. And there's sort of a mystery revolving who did it at that point. And Ryan Gosling's going around asking questions, trying to find someone connected with the death of that actress. And that person is the, I guess, the niece of this woman who wants to, or who wants him to find her. And in the midst of that investigation, Russell Crowe shows up and beats him up because Russell Crowe's working for the girl that Ryan Gosling's trying to find. And he doesn't want him to keep looking for her. But it turns out Russell Crowe had the wrong guy. There was another group of people trying to find her. And these guys are like really serious hitmen. And so through a weird series of circumstances, Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling end up working together. And they're trying to find the girl and keep her safe from the hitmen. Only to have the hitmen start coming after them at a certain point in the movie. And it ends up basically that the girl and the porn actress work together on this movie that was supposed to be, I guess, kind of a parody, but also like seriously trying to take down the auto industry. This whole tie-in with the girl's mother, who's I think she's like the Secretary of Defense or something like that. I can't remember exactly. She has a big important government position, and she's trying to help the automakers get off from some wrongdoing about catalytic converters that they have, where they're like polluting the air. She's trying to get them off in that case, and the film will basically like ruin that case for her, ostensibly. So they're trying to suppress the film, basically, and Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling have to get the film back so that the public can see it and ruin the case for the automakers. I'll not spoil the ending yet. Ooh. We will eventually, though.
Yeah, I thought this movie was all right. I was expecting to hate it, but I thought that Gosling and Russell Crowe had pretty good chemistry together, and that Ryan Gosling was pretty funny in it, and that was enough to carry me through some of the parts that I thought were like pretty big tonal missteps. I still didn't like super like the movie. I'm kind of riding that 2.5 star fence right now, but. I was expecting to find it super boring, and I thought that it was paced well enough that I wasn't super bored. And I don't know. Yeah, I guess compared to my expectations, it was a pleasant enough surprise.
Yeah, I'm pretty much the same. I give this like a 2.5 out of 5. I liked. I surprisingly kind of like Russell Crowe in this. I don't remember liking Russell Crowe in anything before. I thought a lot of the jokes didn't land, and when they didn't land, that was sure was awkward. Because like the movie did kind of play off of you laughing. Like I felt like there were a couple of times there was like a pause in there, in the dialogue or whatever, or sure. Between scene breaks where it's like, oh, right, this is where laughter is supposed to happen. And then it picks up, and then it didn't. I did laugh a couple of times, and it, you know, I don't really remember the movie too well, even though I watched it like 2 days ago, or yesterday, actually. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess the story of me on this podcast is memory loss, because I don't remember anything.
Cinematic amnesia.
Yeah, and I also thought, like, I was kind of hoping they would make the whole being set in the late 70s thing more appropriate, more fun. I don't know. Instead, like, we got, like, one scene that I thought sort of tried to hint it at the weirdness I was kind of hoping this would be.
Yeah. I know the scene you're talking about.
But, yeah. All right. So, yeah, like a C+, I guess.
You mean the highest grade possible?
Yes. It's above average.
I was also expecting to dislike this film, and I really did. I hated it a lot. In fact, I feel somewhat confident it's going to end up on my bottom 10 of the year. I found this movie extremely unpleasant to watch. I found it to be very misanthropic, and I thought that setting it in the 70s was almost uniformly an excuse to make a bunch of sexist and homophobic jokes that, and be like, oh, it's okay, though, because it happened in the 70s. That's, like, something that you can do. And I was like, no, that's not true, Shane Black. Go back to directing that scene where Iron Man falls out of a plane.
Well, I'm going to go big and say 3 stars out of 5. Because, yeah. I liked this movie. I wasn't over the moon about it, but I thought it was just a pretty fun day, pretty fun afternoon at the movies. It was good. I enjoyed it. I think Shane Black, sort of gets how to structure comedy, and he did a good job of not compromising the character just for the sake of the story, like just for the sake of moving the plot forward. I think that he does a good job of keeping those characters kind of consistent throughout and not making them change just to make the plot move in a different direction.
Right.
And I even think that there are times in the story where he could have done that, like he could have compromised that, but he doesn't. He even sort of like avoids what could have been like a big action set piece, to kind of keep the, I guess, keep the characterization pretty consistent, which I thought was a pretty funny step in the plot, because there's a pretty obvious point where you could have like a, Lethal Weapon type shootout in a high-rise hotel, and he basically just makes those characters just completely avoid it. Which I thought was a funny twist in the plot.
Yeah. I mean, that's certainly what I would do if I got on an elevator and then I started to get off and people were shooting each other. I'd just be like, all right,
I'm gonna go back downstairs. Just get back on the elevator, back downstairs. I was like, yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, I don't know. I sort of agree with Ruben that there is something sort of misanthropic about it, and that there's, I don't know, it's like a idea that like the world is chaos. You can't do anything about it. But then by the end, they're like, I don't know, won over by his daughter's sweet naivete and genuine compassion, and they're like, maybe the world's not so bad after all. Maybe we can do something, even if it's small. And I don't know. I was like, I don't know if this movie earned that, because this is the same movie that had the joke where an innocent bystander gets shot in a shootout, and it's a joke both times. And I was like, I don't want to laugh at that. Yeah. It's sad.
That was when I started to dislike the movie, and I was already pretty off board at the point when Amelia gets shot in the face, when he's like, yeah, haha, I just got in this big shootout, and then the person I'm trying to kill ran up to my car, boom, you're dead. And it kind of felt like it wasn't just like, oh, the world is like a terrible place, because that kind of film could be interesting. It was more like, haha, I got you to care about this character or think that she was going to survive, and now I shot her in the face, take that, audience, you're an idiot. And I was like, that's not funny or cool, that's just really mean.
Yeah, I can see how that was kind of a point where I disliked it, and I felt like maybe there was a little bit too constructed at that point, because it was, I guess, playing into the idea that all has to be lost going into the third act. Like, that's sort of the,
yeah, that seemed the super constructed to me. I don't think it was really played for laughs. I think the movie missteps a lot, but I definitely don't think that scene was made to evoke any kind of laughter.
Wes Bentley makes a face that makes me think you're supposed to laugh. Like, it cuts to Wes Bentley's face. And he's just like,
Just before he shoots her, you mean?
Yeah. I thought that was supposed to be the point where you're like, oh shit, oh no. Like, I didn't get humor from it. And I guess also the audience that I saw it with, like, didn't get humor from it. Everybody was like, oh, like, there was kind of a little bit of, I guess, I don't know, you kind of feel a little bit of dislike for her because, you know, it's like, oh, if you'd have just stayed put, like, you would have been okay. But
yeah, I mean, that her characterization is terrible. I mean, she's a terrible character. The whole thing of her being like barely, like, completely psychotic, and yet because she's ranting against capitalism and she's like crazy and that makes her crazy. I don't know, like, there was like, I always felt super uncomfortable during that whole scene where it keeps cutting to Gosling and Crow's like eyebrow raising reactions to her, basically railing against the fact, which is a pretty plausible thing, which is like, yeah, guess what? The auto industry is actually totally gonna get what they want, and guess what, the government is not gonna call them on it, and then everyone's like, yeah, right, stupid girl.
That scene was just a reflection of an earlier scene where they go to her protest group, and it's like, environmental destruction, that's a laugh.
Except the scene with her on the bed, I felt actually got me more, because it really seemed like they were equating those two things, whereas the other like thing was just too weird in and of itself.
I was like, gonna
I could
say
barely the take earlier, it seriously.
Yeah, the earlier scene with the protest group just seemed like it was, the comedy was built more on like Ryan Gosling kind of being in a situation where he didn't know how to act, and so the joke was more kind of like on him, where he was like just didn't get it, and the later scene made it seem more like he was saying like, oh, this girl's kind of like loopy and crazy. But I mean, that, I guess this is the sticky point that does bother me the most about the movie, where it's like, but in the end, like, they are actually buying into what she's saying because they are going to get the film, you know, and they do, like, you know, follow that thread. And so it's like, well, why have this earlier scene where they are like looking at her like she's crazy when she's talking about all this, when it does actually end up being the main point, like the main plot of the movie.
Yeah, that's true.
In the third act.
I think they changed their minds after they get after shot it a killed. Thousand times and she gets killed.
Yeah.
Like, oh, but maybe she was telling the truth.
There's something to this theory.
But I think that part of it is that Shane Black, I mean, maybe similar to like Rob Thomas and Veronica Mars, that there's like, he sees like a cool pragmatic middle ground as like the way to be. So like, I did think he was making fun of the protesters when he's like, why are you wearing that gas mask? Like, shouldn't you be like able to breathe if you wear that gas mask?
Yeah.
That it's like, and similar to her, that she's like sort of like over the top, like sort of seemingly like paranoid conspiracy theorist, and that even though she turns out to sort of be right, like the appropriate response to it is more what Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling do, where they're like, ah, fuck, like, the world's kind of fucked up, but we did our best or whatever, as opposed to being like, don't you see what's going on? Like,
yeah.
Even though they're wrong in that moment, in the end, they're sort of right in that they're like, they're living in the world the way you can. You can't run around being a extremist. You have to just ride that middle line. That's what Shane Black likes.
Be a pragmatist.
Yep.
So, I wanted to add another term to our film vocabulary. So Basil introduced us to the shoot the maid moment. I would like to add the beat up the pedophile moment as like a sort of corollary of a pet the dog moment. Mm. Where it's like, oh,
yeah, God, that's
this
so
guy
tired.
Is like a super gross, disgusting character, but now you immediately like him because his job is beating up pedophiles. And it's like, there's a part of him that's a good guy because that's what he does for his job. And I'm like, no, that doesn't make him a good guy. That makes him someone who takes money to beat people up.
Yeah, that was lazy, for sure.
Well, I don't know though. I got the sense that it still sort of painted him as kind of ruthless. You know, because I mean, he does, I don't know, I guess for most of the movie anyway, like he does like kill that guy who's laying on the pavement after getting hit by the car.
He warned him though about the fish. He was like, you have to come and throw my place and beat me up. That's fine.
It's true. That's the job. It's true, but we get that
scene
between...
You went over the line, so I murdered you.
Yeah. Well, but I still feel like we get that scene between him and the daughter later where she's like, you know, like, did you kill that guy? And he's like, no. And then you kind of like get that moment where you're like, yeah, he did. Like, he's not a good guy because he's like lying to her about
but
this now. So
I think you have to align yourself with the daughter in order to think that he's a bad guy. And like, I feel like Basil, that this movie does nothing to earn her wide-eyed idealism in any other way. Like, Russell Crowe is pretty clearly the moral center of this movie, in my opinion.
I don't know. I don't think so.
Like,
I think
there's an exact moral center, but like, the movie does nothing to convince you that you should like the little girl other than she's a little girl and she goes to where her old house used to be, where I guess maybe her mom died in a fire. It's not made clear, but sort of into that. And like, it's like, here's like, she's kind of quirky and like, she doesn't want people to die. And then like, she sticks on her feet and it's like, oh, don't you like her? And I'm like, no, she doesn't fit in this movie at all. Every time she's on screen, I'm like, I don't know how you put this in the same movie with, you know, random bystanders getting shot played for jokes. Like, that's not, I'm not okay with that.
Well, you could take her as a sort of meta commentary by Black on the fact that, well, the generation that grew up during this like weird, shitty, in some ways, time, was supposed to be like people who were like had like more idealism and whatever. The fact that she is introduced, like the way she, I do agree that she's weirdly placed in this movie most of the time. I feel like the movie does try to make her like sympathetic, when especially when she holds a gun, points a gun at Wes Bentley. That's probably in
that's
this
not Wes Bentley, by the way.
Or
it isn't.
No, I just looked it up. His name's something like Matt Bomer.
Oh yeah, that's right. It is.
Matt Bomer. He looks a lot like Wes Bentley.
Yeah, he does. Like when you first said it, I was like, "Oh shit, that was Wes Bentley."
And yeah, I couldn't remember. I was like, "Oh yeah, he does look like Wes Bentley. You're right." But then I was like, "Oh right, I kept like I saw his name in the credits. I was like, "Oh, you're right. Yeah, it's Matt Bomer."
So no, when she points
he's the hippie dancer in XXL,
right?
The one who does yoga and smudging.
So when she points the gun at not Wes Bentley, whoever that dude is, by the logic of this movie, that like makes her pretty cool because she's, you know, like now she's the one who's like staring down this fucking crazy killer guy and she's not scared of him and whatever. So she's not just all like, people should be good and whatever. But and when it comes down to it, you should also like point guns at people if you need to be and whatever. So that the movie does try to make her seem sympathetic.
Well, I don't think it has to. I mean, I think she seems sympathetic from the beginning, but I think by the end of the movie, I think that it is saying that Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling are not good guys, like at the beginning of the movie. And by the end, they are pulled more closely to her, I guess, emotional gravity. Because, I mean,
I agree with that. I hate it. Okay. I feel like you can't make a movie that's this misanthropic and then put her in it and give this arc that's about how they became slightly better. I think it's insulting to me. Like, it makes me extremely upset.
I don't understand.
If it had just gone deeper and deeper into misanthropy, like, that would have at least been something. Mm. But well, to be like, oh, I'm going to make you feel miserable about all these moments. Like, you're going to laugh at things like that. And then, oh, we're going to give you a little pat on the butt as you walk out of the theater. Like, it's like Saving Private Ryan to me. It's like, we're going to start with this awful, awful stuff and be like, look at the horrors of war, but I have no way to come back from this. So I'm going to give you this cheap pat ending with this old man where he's like, did I earn it? So you can walk out of the theater and be like, oh yeah, the world's not that bad. There are little girls who make us feel better about life. And I'm like, no, get this out of my face.
I don't know if the movies say that though.
I don't understand feeling that way about it. Like, I certainly did not feel that way about it. I don't understand where the, like, I suppose there is a bit of misanthropy, but it always feels like, I don't know, the misanthropy is because, like,
I mean, it's hard to take this movie's misanthropy seriously at all, to me. Like, yes, it's there, but it's there in the same way, like, it's there in a, like, pulpy noir way, where it's, like, very difficult to take most of the shootings or killings in this movie seriously at all. Well, there's also a guy like who's flying out of a window while they're going down the elevator, which is played 100% for laughs. And I don't think that the same movie that
Keith
does
David's
that
body explodes when he hits the ground.
Yeah, so I don't think a movie that does that can be taken seriously when it comes to its like philosophical whatever thing it's trying to get across. And I don't really necessarily agree with the people that say, oh, right, maybe what this movie is saying, that those hippies, they sure were right when it came to the point about pollution. We should have morally done something about that or whatever. I feel like it's also really weird to think that this movie wants you to take home that message, because it doesn't really, I don't know, like, how does that make sense or whatever at the end?
From what I can tell, the misanthropy seems to be a reaction to the world around them. Like, the whole theme seems to be like, the world is kind of fucked up. Like, everything is fucked up. Like, people just get shot randomly. And I don't think you're supposed to laugh at it. Like, I think the idea is to make the landscape seem like brutal in a way. And these characters are just reacting to it and like living in it. The reason that they are bad people is because they live in a world that is like terrible and horrible, and like the 70s just seem horrible. Like, the whole, like, I don't know, like the way the pollution seems to be like suffocating everything in the movie. Like, you get multiple shots of Los Angeles in the 70s where it's just like the smog cloud hanging over, and it's just like, this is a terrible, horrible landscape to live in. And they're kind of rescued by the one like ray of hope, the daughter, who's like the only one who has, you know, like any inclination toward doing good. And they're like, all right, well, she kind of like pulls them back from that world. And I think it's kind of saying too, like, the younger generation in a way with their optimism is kind of like pulling back this, you know, this older world into like the new world a little bit.
That's like a weird time though to set it in. Like, it would make more sense if it was like the 50s and she was like the 60s generation, because like, she's gonna grow up to like Nirvana or whatever. Like, that's not like the beacon of, like, that's like the ultimate and like, oh, the world is stupid and doesn't matter, like, we should stop caring about anything, because,
or be part of the me generation. Yeah, I don't know how old she is exactly, maybe like 12 or something like that.
Yeah, I think she's like graduating.
Graduating college in the mid 80s. She's gonna become a yuppie, like American Psycho generation.
Be a big talking heads.
I mean, you can take something else from it. You can like it if you want, and people don't need to feel the same about films. But saying that the world is an awful place and she's the ray of sunshine is saying what I'm saying, which is that this film is extremely misanthropic. It shows the world to be an awful place, but it gives you this little crumb of hope. And I find that to be insulting in the case of this film. Like, I don't feel like that it makes me more upset. Like, I still wouldn't have liked the film if, like, you know, it just went straight up into misanthropy and like Holly died, and then like, you know, Ryan Gosling just becomes like really gross or whatever and becomes like a murderer. But I was like, at least that would make sense with everything else that happened up until this film at this point.
Right.
like, at least it would fit. Like, this just feels like the scene where she's like, if you kill him, I won't talk to you ever again. I'm like, that. No, I'm not okay with that in a movie that has everything that's led up to that point here.
Yeah, like a Chinatown-esque descent would make more sense for the way the movie's going.
I guess, but I mean, like, I'm okay with that. Like, I'm totally okay with, because, I mean, it seems like a logical turn at the end of the movie where it's like, he spent the movie being this bad guy, and at the end, he's kind of redeemed in a way. Like, I don't understand, like, why that is insulting inherently for you. I mean, it just seems like it's very specific. Like,
I told you why.
No, I mean, I understand. I understand, but, like, you're making it seem like it's inherently insulting, and, like, all right, like, if personally it's insulting for you, I mean, like, that seems like a really logical place for a movie to go.
I mean, a lot of people really like Saving Private Ryan too, but
I feel like that's the
best comparison to how I felt about this movie, which is that it, you know, creates this world of, like, everything is, like, chaotic and entropic and unpleasant, and, you know, there isn't really any morality, and then it doesn't do anything to, like, get your confidence back to be like, hey, like, to, like, slowly introduce, like, the idea that, like, it, you know, everything except for Holly is, like, pretty awful or played for, like, zany laughs. Like, you don't have, like, anything else except for that, and then it just feels tacked on to be like, oh, and this is your, like, ray of hope. It doesn't feel built into the world, like, at all. Like, just as a, for instance, like what Ilya was talking about earlier, like if they just made Amelia like slightly more, you know, under, like, relatable, like, to, you know, to like have these other things going on in the world, or her friend, you know, that is over, who's like, we don't have any cookies left. What are you talking about? No cookies. Like, the fact that there's, like, no communication between her and this other person, it seems like Molly is, like, alone in this world, and that she's literally just planted in the film for only that reason, which is to give the audience some ray of hope at the end. And I don't like that. Mm. Like,
oh, her name's Holly, by the way. But yeah,
that's what I said, Holly.
Oh, I thought you said Molly. Sorry, no. That was my bad ears, not your bad mouth.
But, yeah.
No, I mean, I agree with basically what Ruben's saying, in that, I don't know. Like, there are times that it's definitely played for laughs. Like, that weird guy on stilts that gets shot while he's fighting Keith David at the party, and he's like, whoa, 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 and, like, falls backwards. I'm like, this is not a good joke. This is that poor guy was just hanging out at a party, and then he got shot. Like, that's not,
I don't even remember that part.
Yeah, at the sex worker party. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, I don't know what the theme of that party is supposed to be. Weird things, I guess.
Yeah, wacky costumes.
It's mermaids and Native American people, and a guy on stilts who's like dressed like a tree. And oh, and the scene before the that guy. Is even okay, kind yeah, of yeah, okay. kind of played for laughs too, when he falls down the hill and then he goes to light a cigarette and you see the guy. And then he can't light the cigarette, and he lights the lighter again, and then he notices him. And I was like, that was the point when I went, this is something that is played like it's a new-ish technique, and it was being made fun of in the Slumber Party Massacre in the 80s. Like, and they did that with like the TV and the radio at the beginning, too. It's like, oh, here's important information conveyed on the TV and radio that you know is going to be important later that seems like it's not relevant at this point. And I was like, again, this is something that happens in the Slumber Party Massacre that is satirized like 25 years ago. And here they're playing it like either for laughs or like, you know, as like a legitimate writing technique. And I'm like, that's not, that's bad. The one thing that I did like about this movie though is Hannibal Buress.
As the
yes. I don't understand why that scene is in the film. I don't understand, like, what it adds to the film. But as soon as it cut to Hannibal Buress' voice, and he was like, "Hey, man, I'm Bumble," sitting in the back seat, I was like, "That's pretty funny." Hannibal Buress is always funny.
Yeah, there's a small reference early on that Ryan Gosling's really scared of killer bees. That, like, he's worried that the killer bee epidemic is gonna.
Yeah.
That's why they called. You know why they call them killer bees? Because they kill.
But yeah, I don't know. The scene with the porn star, I was not happy with
the opening. You mean the opening scene? I hated the fact that they pushed in on her in this like super skeezy kind of way, and then had like the boy cover her up. I guess in what would eventually foreshadow the entire movie, where it's like the young kids are like the only ones who have like any kind of dignity. And I guess if they would have just played off of that and not taken it too seriously, I guess it would have worked with Holly too.
But it's also still like a weird joke, because he's like staring at a centerfold of her right when the car crashes through his house.
Yeah, right.
And I was like, this is gross. Like,
well, it's the obvious thing. It's like, oh, it's easy to objectify, like when you don't actually see the person. When you do see it, if you have any humanity, you won't. So I guess that was the whole point of that.
I guess so. I mean, like, but again, like, I don't think that the movie is taking this stuff too seriously. Like, this none of this movie feels like it's being taken seriously. Like, I don't know.
But I mean, like, the violence is so brutal. I feel like I guess obviously Hollywood disagrees, but I feel like once you
have crossed this, it has that sound effect thing going on too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where you like are like, this is what it really looks like when somebody's head gets shot open or whatever. I'm like, you can't have that and have it be like a wacky hijinks movie to me. Like, it's too much. Like, it's my big problem with Ghost Protocol is that, like, he's punching people and it, like, sounds like he's really breaking limbs. And I'm like, this is weird for a movie that otherwise wants to be a Looney Tunes cartoon. I don't like it.
Yeah. I mean, I would just say that in my experience, Quentin Tarantino seems to be, like, the only person who can be kind of an exception to that, where I feel like he can show like extremely brutal, sometimes even realistic violence, and then manage to also pull laughs from like the same movie. But he does it in a way that he managed to balance the tone in a way that very few people can.
I guess that's a specific thing, though. Like, it's very difficult to argue how he balances that tone. You could also make the point.
I mean, he usually doesn't put it in the same scene as, like, one thing. So, like, I just thinking of the part in Django Unchained where he fights off, like, 100 dudes or whatever, and there's, like, blood everywhere, and it's, like, pretty serious, and then he gets captured, and he gets whipped a bunch, and it's, like, it's all pretty serious. But then when he comes back at the end and, like, shoots the mistress of the plantation, and she's like pulled by like a rope like 30 feet backwards, and it's like clearly played for laughs. Like, maybe the fact that there's like so much time between those scenes then works differently.
I was thinking more about the scene in Pulp Fiction where they shoot Marvin in the car, which is also played 100% for laughs, but you could argue that it's
I would like that scene
super tone deaf.
I mean, I think he's gotten does better not at age it well.
Yeah.
I feel like I would have this complaint about his earlier films. I guess I would add Edgar Wright to that list as well, because he sometimes shows like pretty realistic looking violence and also manages to like have funny parts. But again, it's kind of the same thing.
Super
like,
gory.
Like the first 2/3 of Shaun of the Dead are pretty funny, and then I kind of feel like after that one guy that we don't like gets like ripped in half, they're like the movie doesn't find any humor and gore after that. Kind of like a breaking point intentionally.
Yeah, for sure. And the violence in Hot Fuzz is super gory, but then at the very end, like, it shows that no one actually died, which is a pretty funny joke. Like, even though a bunch of people got shot and like stabbed and stuff, they're all alive and just get arrested. But
I guess so. I mean, I don't know. I feel like the fact that you have Ryan Gosling's character, like, after all this stuff happens, like, at the end saying that, like, well, at least nobody got hurt. Be like, no, a lot of people died. He's like, oh, yeah, but I think...
I mean, it's a funny line.
I think it's acknowledging, like, the mixture of, like, you know, oh, here's gory violence, but here's also, like, a really, like, stupid way of looking at it. Like, well, yeah, a lot of people died. Like, I feel like it's acknowledged enough in the film that it doesn't bother me. So, I mean, I guess it, you know, it bothers you, but it doesn't bother me. So, whatevs.
Agree to disagree.
My favorite kind of agreement.
But I did feel like, well, to like change the subject almost completely, that this is the first, I think, Russell Crowe performance where it felt like he was, like, on board. Like, I feel like generally he tends to be, like, a sort of annoying, like, actor, where he's like, I'm the guy in this scene. This is my movie. And I felt like he played off Ryan Gosling pretty well.
Yeah, his performance was pretty fine. I didn't care for Ryan Gosling's.
It's kind of disappointing.
I thought he was very funny in this movie. Like, this is, I guess, the funniest that I've seen him be. I haven't seen a lot of his comedic
Lost River. I mean, he didn't act in that movie, but that movie was hilarious.
I was not on that. I wasn't on that podcast, so I haven't seen Lost River. But
Lost River.
I think he does a great job with physical comedy in this movie. Like, I think he does a fantastic job in that scene where he's in the bathroom and he's like trying to hold the gun on Russell Crowe and hold the door open, and then he drops his cigarette in his pants, and I was just like, this is a really funny scene, and he's doing a good job of like being bumbling but also like making me believe that he's really trying to like accomplish this and not just screw it up. Like, it looks believably like something you would do when you were like trying to do too many things at once with your hands. And I was like, that's a really, like, that takes a lot of concentration to do that as an actor. And it's a funny scene. Like, to be able to, he plays it straight enough that it's still like believable that he's kind of a goofball. Like, you know, he's not like he's in the role of like the, you know, the private detective, but he's, I don't know. I like those shots again where it's like where somebody offers him more money to do something that you absolutely know that they shouldn't be offering him money for, and he like stops and is like, am I gonna take this money? Where it's like, I don't know, I find that kind of like Looney Tunes despicableness to be funny in these characters.
Just like Despicable Me. Favorite movie from 2011. I also thought Gosling was funny in certain parts.
Didn't dislike his whole thing, but I was kind of hoping the whole performance would be a bit more, I don't know, just memorable. I don't know, like he would own it more. There would be somewhat more of a pronounced character there. The way I kind of didn't really like the way Black kind of hinted at his dark past or whatever. Like, that whole thing could have been handled like it's like a very writerly way of pretending that there's more to the character than there really is. I felt like, so, yeah, I feel like Ryan Gosling is really good at being, like, handsome and smooth, and I would have actually liked more of that in this movie, like, because I was hoping it would, like, go for more of, like, a goofy sort of vibe, when it did, I thought it worked for me much more than when it got, like, weirdly serious and,
if he was like more like a drunken Columbo, I'd be down with that.
Yeah.
So, sort of shabby, but
Yeah, I mean, I like I really like the gag where he thinks, like, where he like is like, oh, it's not at the airport though, because they have like this whatever a thing from after 10 p.m. where there's no planes that leave or whatever, and it sounds like super plausible, and they get there, it's like, okay, yeah, let's go to the airport. Like that was one of those definitely written jokes that worked pretty well for me. Because he's not as genius as he thinks he is.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I also like the way they kind of like, they always have him like saying these really cliched things, like where he says, "You're not really a murderer." She just said she murdered three people. And he's like, "I know, but like deep down," like him having to qualify those like really cliched things that he says is really funny to me.
Can't be a murderer because she's super hot.
Yeah. He wants to have sex with her because she does card tricks with his daughter.
Yep. That's, hey, what more do you need?
I like how like deluded he is in that whole plot line where he's just like so into the idea that she's a good person.
Yeah.
That he still refuses to believe it even when she's pointing a gun at him.
I mean, I feel like
if you
take the thing in the beginning where you said there's a beat up the pedophile moment, you could have the same sort of thing for supporting actors, which is a play with my kids moment where that character eventually turns out to be like, oh yeah, I might marry that girl or whatever. And she does not play any role in the movie. But then later, like the main character somehow is depicted like on a date with her or whatever. And then it's like, oh, that's good because she was good with his kids, remember?
Yeah,
and I feel like this movie
does kind of work though because
they kind of twist
satirizing it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. Exactly what I'm saying. In this movie, they actually make fun of that. If anything, so
yeah. Not everyone who's good with children
is automatically a good person. Yeah, good person. Good with children for like 1 minute. So like.
Oh man, I did not like Kim Basinger's performance at all. I mean, I feel bad beating up on her because I don't think I've ever liked a performance by her, but she's such a like flat non-entity for like a pretty pivotal role in the movie.
What about 8 Mile, Basil? What about that great performance?
Well, I was going to say she looks, I don't know, like there's something weird about the way she looks and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. It's like she's like just gotten out of the shower or something like that, like in all her scenes, like I can't quite put my finger on, like there's something weird about the
Basinger. She looked, you on set,
did she look,
I'm showering,
did she look damp?
I'll be out there when I'm out there.
She looks like she hasn't quite dried her hair all the way.
It just like comes like, back in
yeah
the
it's like it's like
she just has a, yeah, an overall damp feel to her performance. Yeah.
Did y'all think that like combining her and Russell Crowe and like the setting of the film was like, this is the LA Confidential of the 2010s.
I didn't even pick up on that connection, but that's funny.
yeah. Man, that Detroit line was really weird. The way she delivered it was really weird.
Yeah, that's, I mean, to me, it's another continuation of like, it's kind of like the reverse of the climate thing. It's like, oh, in the 70s, like this is a laugh, isn't that funny? And then that's a laugh in reverse because like, oh yeah, Detroit was like this all-powerful thing in the 70s. It's like now that town is like dust.
Yeah,
it's true.
Like the car companies all had to be bailed out and like they like,
yeah,
they're still like not that powerful even after they got a bunch of money.
And they were
Detroit's like,
yeah, we're already kind of falling apart around that time, though. Like, around Vietnam War. Pretty bad time for Detroit.
Yeah. Gas crisis. They hinted that for a second at the gas station.
Yeah.
You can only buy 10 gallons at a time. Can you imagine?
Mm-hmm. So, it just, I only said that because it kind of also makes her then sound more deluded at the time already, not just like as an in hindsight sort of madmen can you believe those people in those times sort of joke.
I sure don't like Mad Men. That's almost entirely aesthetically, not so much in the writing.
But the aesthetic is what everyone praises about it, Ruben.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I kind of like the costuming in Mad Men, and I kind of like the costuming here. I thought they did a pretty fun job with some of the ways that people looked and dressed and stuff like that. I mean, that's what you want to see in a movie that's set in the late 70s. You know, like I was kind of feeling like they could have done a little bit more of that. I don't know. I guess my hope was to see like a goofy noir thing set where like people go from one disco club to another and like are generally like pretty, I don't know. Like there's a lot of stuff that was bad about the 70s, but like it was also the time where very disparate sort of groups of people kind of worked together and got together and kind of, I don't know, I guess made for a less segregated sort of world for a bit, at least in certain types, in certain places, in certain spheres. I don't think the movie got at that like at all. It's just like, oh, remember the 70s with the wacky colors and the goofy hairdos and like, oh, remember Sly and the Family Stone? Papa was a Rolling Stone. Sly and the Family Stone. Yeah.
opens with Papa's a Rolling Stone.
And like the soundtrack is pretty obvious and stuff, but it was good. It was just like, you know, it's pretty like what you already knew about the 70s. There you go. I'll again.
Thank God it's Friday.
Yeah, I guess. Still waiting for that 70s movie I actually really like. I guess I'll take Roller Boogie over this, over both of them.
I would also take Roller Boogie over this.
None of you would, I guess.
No. Nope, I would.
No. Not even close.
3 stars Roller for Roller Boogie from me.
It's at least, like, just poorly made. That's my problem with Roller Boogie.
Shabbily constructed.
I don't know. I feel like this
like actually makes me upset.
That's Shane Black for you.
This is not at all an intentional reference, unlike the LA Confidential thing, which I feel like is like a subtle intentional thing. But another movie that this movie reminded me of is The Boondock Saints, which is that it's also a misanthropic movie that kind of wants to like offer like a ray of hope at the end of the film, but that like the part when I realized that it reminded me of The Boondock Saints is like kind of an inverse moment, which is like, so there's like that goofy sidekick in The Boondock Saints who's like, we could kill everybody or whatever, and then the inverse moment happens with Ryan Gosling in this movie. It's like, I think I can't die, I can't be hurt or whatever, and like for some reason his delivery of that line reminded me of that other line, and I was like, oh, that's probably part of the reason why I don't like this movie.
I kind of like that line, though. I thought it was exactly at the right moment when, like, and it played well with his character as someone who never does the appropriate thing at any moment, basically. So,
what about when he pretended to be drunk so he could get the best of Keith David?
Yeah, that was like, I did not understand how that could have been ever confused for someone who was drunk.
Like he was acting the exact same as when he was poorly acting drunk earlier. So.
Ryan Gosling, I guess his character was doing the poor acting, I guess, in this sense. So maybe he does a good, character who's a bad actor thing, but,
When he was legitimately drunk at the other party, he acted exactly the same. So I think that's how Ryan Gosling thinks drunk people act. As a Mouseketeer, maybe Shane he's Black. Never drank anything.
Well, good for him. You know, maybe Ryan Gosling is not a drinker.
He's got a lot of range, but alcoholism's not in his wheelhouse.
I mean, you don't really get to look like that if you chug down 3-4 beers a day. Probably not. So,
that's true.
Good on you, Gus.
The movie kind of had a thing that, like, it didn't, or it had a moment that Basil normally complains about, but it did it not in the way that he does it, where someone gets hit by a car and they do stop for a second and they're like, oh no, and then they're like, whatever, and then they drive off. Anyway, like, he's always complaining, like, they never even, like, stop, like, a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's, they're like, what they happened? Oh no, it's bad, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
Which is plausible enough, yeah. Especially if you're...
Way more plausible. Like,
but yeah, like, bus driver just runs somebody over and it's like, I got a lot of people to drop off, can't stop now. We're already behind schedule.
Does that happen in one of the Final Destination movies?
Yeah, the very first one. She's like, complaining, and she's like, really, like, yelling at everyone else that this whole thing about, you know, death being after them is stupid and they shouldn't believe it, and then a bus just goes bang
and it just keeps going, right?
Yeah, it doesn't stop or slow down at all.
It's pretty good. Maybe we should do Final Destination 1 through 7 by now.
I believe there's 5 movies.
5.
Yeah, there are 5, and I've already seen all of them, so
yeah, me too.
I'm not psyched to watch the really bad ones again.
Yeah. The only one, like, yes, most of those movies are really bad, but the, you know, at least, like, the first scene or whatever is always not the first scene, but the scene where everybody dies, it's always, like, kind of enjoyable about it, except for about the first movie, which I find takes itself way too seriously.
Mm.
Yeah, they didn't realize that it was a joke until the second movie. Yeah.
They were real proud of that.
It gets really goofy.
I can't remember. Isn't the same director as Snakes on a Plane?
If I remember. Who did the second one?
David R. Ellis.
David R. Ellis.
Doesn't he do another one? Doesn't he do, like, the Final Destination as well?
Yeah, which is the worst one. That one makes me sad.
Yeah.
But... yeah, I can no longer defend his auteurism in spite of still liking Cellular.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Which is a lot of fun. Also, yeah, Kim Basinger in that, right?
Yeah, Kim Basinger, true. Yeah.
I guess I didn't hate her in that one. she was okay.
At least in the Final Destination, it introduces a new wrinkle where if you murder the, like, person in front of you, then death will skip you or whatever. I can't remember exactly how it goes.
Wow.
It's true.
Solid.
Even more complex morality. Mm. You're like,
pass it on.
How much do I like you?
Which one just was like the one follows. Where you could, like, where they had the DVD where you could pick if someone lived or died? I can't remember which one that was, but one of them, the DVD.
I don't think that's any of them.
No. This was a real thing. Like, the DVD had a thing where you could, like, go through and, like, it was like a select an adventure. Like, you could pick, oh, this person lives, or this person dies.
Like, that would change the scene. That was depending.
A real, yeah, that was a real thing that happened with one of them. I can't remember which one it was.
Mm.
Well, I didn't watch them on DVD, so I guess I missed out on that.
Yep.
It's true. You could have saved them all, Ruben. You chose not to.
That's an interesting gimmick.
My favorite one of those is everyone's least favorite, and that's the third one. But
that one's not my least favorite, but a lot of people, I haven't seen it since the theater.
I mean, it stars Mary Elizabeth Winstead, and I feel like having, like, a pretty good actor at the center of the movie carries it through a lot of the rough patches.
That's crazy, I didn't know that was her. I remember her performance being good. There's, like, some part where she has to cry or whatever, and I was like, "Well, this is really believable crying for a cheap horror movie."
Where did I watch her in? Oh, right, the 10 Cloverfield Lane thing, right?
That's, yeah.
She's
pretty good in that.
Mm. I need to see that. I'm interested to see it.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, I liked it.
I also haven't seen it, but it's already out of the second run theater.
Still have not seen Cloverfield, it's on though. So
rentable video.
Or you could drive to Oregon and see it. We're playing it for at least a week at my theater.
Nice. I'm sure it'll come up on Netflix at some point. It seems like the type of movie that would
make especially it once they make it a whole franchise of like weird movies having like some sort of relevance to that universe.
It's true. What will the next one be? Cloverfieldville.
Yeah.
When Cloverfield Met Sally, a romantic comedy, takes place after a global terror event.
It's a rom-com, The Giant Monster. Like the woman and the giant monster, there's like a meet cute.
Just like in the background. So like, can we...
Oh, but she's having...
Like, can we find love in a world in which giant monsters are destroying the world?
A world where the U.S. government is trying to kill me.
No, not a rom-com with the monster. A rom-com with people trying to find love.
Oh,
and a
that's
world
more
with
plausible.
Monsters.
Mine was insane. My premise was crazy.
That Cloverfield monster already found love since it like birthed those weird things that lived in the sewer.
Yeah. What about Crimson and Cloverfield, the story of this.
Is that where the monster starts a band, like a 70s cover band?
Yes. It's like, I'm going to make it big.
It's like The Commitments, but with
I might, monster. I may be a monster, but I'm going to make it big. Against all odds. Like I'm going
to
learn the guitar.
Like a bass guitar that like its fingers can like crush.
Exactly. So most of the movie is him just building a guitar that he can play.
Finding strings that are strong enough gauge for him.
Crushing trees.
It's like, oh no, Cloverfield is destroying the Golden Gate Bridge. No. It's like, no, I'm just taking
the... No, he wants to play.
I just want to play the guitar. Just taking the...
Just like playing it like a harp.
And like by the end of the movie, like the whole of the world is crushed, and then it like finally dawns on like the last guy alive. It's like, oh, he was playing the song.
The music is just so beautiful.
It's so good. I'm glad I get to hear this.
And then the earth explodes. Yeah.
We should pitch that, definitely. Mm-hmm. Very pitchable.
That movie also has Lizzie Kaplan not being funny in it.
True.
Oh, Cloverfield? Right, yeah.
Too many movies where they don't let Lizzie Kaplan be funny.
What? Yeah, why don't more people let Lizzie Kaplan be funny in things?
Party Down. New.
I know, right? Score. Have you seen her in Party Down?
Here's this funny actress. We're going to have her be really funny.
Well, that's why I do like the movie Bachelorette, which you don't like. But
is she funny in that?
She's.
I don't remember.
She's really funny in it, yeah.
Isn't Kirsten Dunst in that movie too?
Yeah.
Yep.
They like
I'm
snorting
to
cocaine together.
Kirsten Dunst and Lizzie Kaplan doing coke.
That's a movie that I don't like, but I like better than Bridesmaids because it is a movie that never tries to pull back from its grossness or whatever.
It's pretty obviously
people are gross and we're just gonna ride that gross wave.
We're
going to
celebrate our grossness.
Like,
yeah.
Where it's like Bridesmaids, it's like, oh man, women can be gross too, but they can also come together and be friends at the end of the movie and sing a Wilson Phillips song together.
Mm.
And I'm like, no, thank you.
And forgive Rose Byrne for being extra gross.
And not forgive the romantic male interest because the movie does not at all blame him for screaming at her for not opening a new cupcake shop or whatever after the first one fails.
You gotta pull yourself up by your bootstraps. That's what Melissa McCarthy said.
Like, I know that we've had sex once and been on like 3 dates, but I feel totally at ease just yelling at you how much you're screwing up your life.
It's a tactic that always works.
Yeah. Especially in real life. It's men go up to women who are like kind of interested in them, maybe, and it's like, I can't believe you're not loving me! Love me, you idiot! This is the thing that you're messing up the most! And then they're like, I'm into that. That's what I like.
Yep. You're right. Thanks for showing me the way. What a cool movie.
Yep.
Can't wait for Ghostbusters.
Me too. Did y'all read the article written by Tony Zhao comparing the trailer for Ghostbusters in America and the trailer for Ghostbusters in England?
No.
It's a pretty good article.
Is the UK trailer way better or something?
I haven't watched either trailer, but I mean, that is his argument, is that the UK trailer is actually edited with, like, make jokes land and stuff like that, and he, you know, goes through like how much editing has to do with humor and the things that the UK trailer does differently from the US trailer.
It's pretty cool, man. It's getting real noir-y up in Germany.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
we started this.
This is just when the sun is setting, so it's like 8:30 here. So
where's our ray of hope to pull us back from the darkness?
Here it comes. Here it is.
Cellular telephones.
Lighting up my life.
With a picture of some whiskey.
What is that? What's that? Was that Slurricane?
Yeah. This was. This is a blog that. Suggest like cheap stuff to buy online, and one of their suggestions is a whiskey bottle.
Oh, is it whiskey? It looked like the have you seen the E40 drink
and the
Slurricane?
And it's like this. It's 30 euros instead of 34, which I'm sure was totally worth posting.
Wow. Dude.
What a saving.
Yeah.
What a savings. that's the best line in Galaxy Quest. Minecraft's Arts Hammer. What a savings.
LeBron James is the greatest basketball player of all time.
Yeah.
Whoa, controversial.
Controversial.
That started
some
discussion.
I've been saying that everywhere, so I felt like I should say it here too.
We should start a podcast about that.
I feel like,
and then the podcast is just like 35 seconds. It's like intro music, and then it's like a short pause, and then I go, LeBron James is the greatest basketball player of all time, and then just outro music.
Yeah. Maybe like some really bombastic music. Like the music needs to like, and then it comes in, and you're just like, LeBron.
Yeah, with like an announcer voice too. And it's like, Ruben Clay with the LeBron James podcast. LeBron James really is the greatest basketball player of all time.
And then have like an hour and a half of dead air, so it seems like a real podcast.
Yeah, it's just like a real drop the mic moment.
Yep.
I feel like that is not a.
I can't believe there are
necessarily
people in
wrong
2016
statement.
Who think that Kobe is a better player. Than
That's
LeBron.
Really funny to me. That's really funny like, to me, especially when they start pretending that his defense was anything like great. Like, but it was, and it wasn't just that Kobe just like tried for about 2 years, and that's when they gave him like. The first team defense, because back then they didn't have any way of properly tracking good defensive stats. So, yeah.
Yeah. Like, there are definitely players who you can argue are better than LeBron. Like, I don't agree with those arguments, but, you know, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
Kobe Bryant is clearly in tier 2 of, like, the great players. Mm-hmm. Like,
Yeah, I mean, he's you know, up there or whatever, but like, yeah, not even the top 10 probably.
It's, you know, I can tell you what it is. It's, I think it's just a numbers thing. It's like Los Angeles is a bigger market than Cleveland.
That's probably true.
Like,
yeah. And he was luckier to play with greater teams. If LeBron and Shaq had played together in their prime, they would have won 11 titles.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
That would have been an unstoppable combination.
I mean, hell, if Kobe and Shaq hadn't, you know, like if Shaq had had Kobe's killer instinct and Kobe had been like slightly more gregarious and like passed the ball and like not been like, oh, I need to have my own team, then they probably would have won like 10 titles together. Like, I was trying to think, and other than maybe Magic and Kareem was at the end of his career when the two of them played together, have there ever been two players that good who played together, like, both in their primes? I don't think so.
Yeah, probably MJ Pippen would be, like, a close second.
Yeah.
That would probably be a close second. Otherwise, yeah. Hard to think of something off the top of my head. I guess like 70s LA teams or whatever. Like, or what was it? The one where Wilt played with... did he ever play with Jerry West? I don't remember. I guess,
yeah.
I guess not, because he came late.
But I mean...
But that would have been a pretty good combo too. There were like some dominant combos, and every good team ever was like a lot of really good players on that team, like super dominant players. So it's kind of a myth to think that like one player is supposed to carry an entire team with him and never join forces.
Oh, but Kobe only had Pau Gasol. Yeah. Only Pau Gasol, one of the top 10 power forwards of all time. Only him.
Yeah. Yeah.
During one of the weakest eras in NBA talent,
right?
I really think that Lakers team like could beat like today's Thunder team? I don't.
They barely beat that Thunder team.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right. So, any more nice guys thoughts on basketball?
I laughed at a couple parts. That Hannibal Buress is funny.
Yeah.
I need to watch the other two Hannibal Buress movies that came out that same weekend. I remember one of them was Neighbors 2 Sorority Rising, but I don't remember what the third one was. Oh, Angry Birds.
Oh my god.
Wow.
Angry Birds. No, thank you.
So his face only appears in one of the three movies that he was in that weekend. Support your local Hannibal Buress, people. Go see Hannibal Buress.
Yeah, watch all his specials on Netflix. I've seen every one of his specials on Netflix.
I like this movie so much more if Hannibal Buress played the Ryan Gosling role. It was just Hannibal Buress being confused the whole time. It's like, whoa, did you see that guy? He just died. Hannibal Buress should just be replaced the main character in every movie.
That's true.
He could do it.
They should do a buddy cop movie with him and Jason Mantzoukas.
Oh my god. Jason Mantzoukas is 100% like the funniest thing about the league. Like, I finished watching season 6 of the league, and
Parks and Rec, I think Jason Mantzoukas is the funniest thing of almost anything that he's in. Parks and Rec is the only thing where he doesn't really play a character that I like, and then there are a lot of other funny people on it.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
there's people put Jason Mantzoukas for 10 minutes in a bad comedy, and he steals the show.
He's so good in Dirty Grandpa. That movie is, I could have denounced that movie, but I wasn't going to, just because Jason Mantzoukas is super, super funny in it.
Nice.
Oh my god. There was a joke at the end of one of the seasons of the league where they get this choir to sing about what a shitty person Kevin is, and like they finish singing the song and it like cuts to a wide shot and Rafi's sitting across the aisle from him. He goes, "Hey Brian, who's this Kevin guy? He sounds like a real piece of shit." Him always calling that character Brian instead of Kevin is so funny to me.
Yep. I don't actually like him that much on Comedy Bang Bang, though, which is weird because like that's where he's like allowed to be himself a lot, and I don't really love him very much.
What like, about really? Have the biscuit made?
On the radio show?
Yeah, I feel like he just like I don't know. I never really I feel like other people work better on that show than him. I feel like I like him in movies, but I kind of for some reason. And I don't really like him on that movie podcast either.
Oh, I love
that's
him.
That's why I like him the best.
Yeah, how did this get made? He's so funny on that.
You're wrong.
I never listened to Comedy Bang Bang, but I love Jason Mantzoukas on podcasts, especially when he talks about his egg allergy.
He manages to make like super weird, gross, like horny sex jokes funny, like. I don't know how.
One time when I didn't like him was when he was on the Time Travelers podcast, whatever that was called, with Paul Tompkins, where he played H.G. Wells, and he would.
Dead Authors podcast.
Dead Authors podcast. I think he played
Plato.
Yeah, he plays Plato, and he just talks about having sex with young boys like almost the entire podcast, and I'm like, I'm not into this.
Yeah, I feel like he has too much of a shtick on the movie podcasting. Well, the way how did it get made?
I don't
it's
know.
Like
I
super like shticky.
I think that's what he does best, though. I think his shtick, like that's all he does on the league, is like shtick. Like that whole character is shtick, and it's a really funny shtick. Like somehow he makes that weird, gross, horny shtick like work somehow. I don't know how he does it. Like normally I don't like characters who are like that, but he makes that character so insane.
All right guys, I'm disappearing into the darkness here already. Yeah, yeah. If you can see,
we need to
I think you can see my shoulder out
so that
my shoulder outline
up so that Ilya can get out of the dark,
but I will be swallowed up by darkness in like a minute, so
turn on some lights in that place.
Let's say bye-bye.
Do you not have electricity in Munich?
It's over with that. Well, it's way over there. And plus, I need to go make dinner. So, sorry, listeners.
I have to go shower. I got invited to a Belmont Steaks party today. So, I'm going to go watch the ponies. That's right. I don't really care about horse racing. But I like parties.
You should start betting on it. I like then you'll care.
No, thank you.
Then you'll care way too much. You can get extremely angry like you do about other sports.
I have enough problems with money to like waste it on betting on something. I have no idea how it works.
That's never stopped me, but good on you.
I hate gambling. Gambling's like, I don't know.
I just go like
never, I've never understood the appeal.
It's disappeared.
I feel like maybe I'll lose a lot of money.
I've only ever bet on the horses once and I won. And I never did again. I was like, all right, batting 1,000.
I have enough like emotionally invested in sports to like worry about monetary investment.
Speaking of, if you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe using your podcast listening app and get invested in this podcast by giving us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
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 Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.